Hello, Ann.
Hi, Con.
Hi. We're sitting here on Jobs Day. The Labor Department came out with their jobs report on the Friday before Labor Day. So it's both Jobs Day and Labor Day weekend.
Indeed. And not the happiest of Labor Days, really.
Not the happiest. Before we get into that, my name is Con Carroll. I'm the official blogger here at the Heritage Foundation.
And I'm Ann Friedman. I'm the deputy editor here at the American Prospect magazine.
Cool. So were you expecting? I think everyone was expecting a bad jobs report here.
Yeah, I mean, even when you're expecting it, it's hard not to also note how truly terrible they are. and, you know, if you are of the Democratic persuasion, you know, not the best news in the electoral sense either.
Right, right. Sticking with the Jobs Day stuff, I mean, we have another loss in employment, 54,000 total, unemployment going to 9.6%, and this will be the third straight month of job losses after two early reports showed job gains in the 200,000 and 400,000 territory, which were all census jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely bad news for the Democrats heading into the midterms. Did you watch the president's press conference? Was ended just minutes ago?
I actually didn't. I was doing other things. So do you want to fill us in on that?
No, you didn't miss much. You know, he just said the economy is improving, but you know, he said he's going to have some stuff that he's going to propose next week, but he didn't want to say what it was now. A reporter tried to ask him if he regretted the recovery summer label. And he kind of dodged the question and said that the economy is recovering, but it just needs to recover faster.
Mm-hmm.
So didn't want to admit that recovery summer is his mission accomplished yet.
Well, but, I mean, I think maybe it was also an optimistic label. I mean, you know.
No, they really believed. I mean, you know, I wrote my morning blog post today was looking back at, you know, Joe Biden was campaigning for, I forget the guy's name who replaced Murtha. But anyways, the guy who replaced Murtha back in April in Pennsylvania, and Joe Biden said that the economy was going to start growing by 500,000 jobs a month.
Mm-hmm.
And the next report, it was up 250,000, and the next report after that was up 400,000. So Joe looks really smart. And then, of course, the census stopped creating jobs, and the private sector didn't pick up the slack. So no, I think they're true believers over there in the White House. I think they really thought that recovery summer was going to work, and well, it didn't.
I mean, I don't know. I guess I just think that they've been pretty cautious about this all along. I mean, I don't know that. I mean, and part of this dovetails with Kristi Romer's goodbye speech from this week, where
from Wednesday.
You know, what she said was, you know, I thought, you know, it was pretty balanced and basically unobjectionable. But, you know, economists as a whole are a cautious group. And to hear her say things like, you know, we didn't really know the extent of the problem when we started out with this, I thought rang a little false to me. I mean, maybe.
Well, it rang really false to me. I mean, for a number of reasons, is that, you know, first of all, she goes on, like you said, to say, oh, we didn't know how bad it was. And then, you know, she even says, you know, economists right now can't figure out why, you know, the GDPs aren't matching the job totals. So she's basically admitting that the Keynesian, the old Keynesian formulas aren't working, that they're just not making sense of this economy.
Well, I disagree with the second part of that. Sorry, go on.
Okay.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Her speech is up there. We can you know, look and see what she said. But, you know, she said that, you know, the link just isn't there in this recession. And so then she then turns around and basically uses those same exact formulas to say that it's proven that the stimulus worked. So, yeah, I think the American people are definitely losing faith in Keynesian economics, in large part thanks to Romer and Bernstein and their famous recovery chart.
I mean, I don't think the American people connect what's happening with jobs to this, like, large debate about Keynesian economics. I mean, like, you and I in Washington can, like, make that assumption. But I think that, you know, for people on the ground, it's not about, you know, I mean, I don't know, Kristi Romer's speech as a large news item in most of America is another debatable point. But, you know, I don't think that, like, this is a referendum on the stimulus for folks. Like, I really don't. And maybe, you know, people who are watching cable TV every day see it as that. But I think that, you know, it's really just a matter of, like, are there jobs in my hometown? It's not, it's divorced from stimulus and the fact that the Obama administration didn't go far enough with Keynesian economics. I mean, they didn't, you know, Christy Romer is saying that, you know, this is why she sounds hedging, in my opinion. It's like, you know, we had one set of beliefs about how we were going to attack this problem, and we didn't follow through with it all the way and didn't really push for it because we're cautious economists. And the result is that, you know, it didn't work. It didn't work to the extent that it should have.
Well, I think we can all agree it didn't work. But, you know, I'm going to agree with Paul Krugman here, is that there, I think there is definitely a larger debate playing out here, and the credibility of Keynesian economics is at stake. Mm-hmm. There is a reason why the White House is so deathly afraid of calling whatever they do come up with next week anything but a second stimulus or stimulus.
Right.
I think the Politico called today emergency fixes or something like that. They'll have some cute name for it, but it won't be stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
Because I kind of disagree with you. I do think voters, people who are paying attention, registered voters who are likely to vote this year, do believe that the stimulus has failed, and they have looked at the package that went through and what has happened afterwards, and have largely decided that Keynesian economics just doesn't explain what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, the more troubling thing to me, I mean, and this dovetails with the job numbers thing, is, you know, I don't know if you saw the article in the New York Times today about 18 to 29-year-olds, and, you know, young people are one of the highest, one of the groups with the highest unemployment rates. And I think that, you know, there are some groups that definitely connect with, you know, the stimulus language and the types of work that was supposed to be created by the stimulus. And then there are other folks like, you know, the people in my sort of, like, age and demographic cohort who I don't know if they expected the stimulus to really directly affect them. I think that there's sort of this perception that it was, like, construction jobs and infrastructure jobs, and it was not the sort of thing that ever promised, you know, new college graduates that they were going to have a better time, you know, when they sent out a bajillion resumes.
No, they were supposed to take their, you know, all their new engineering degrees and, mm-hmm. and go work at you know, green jobs plants and wind farms and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, but the number of people planning wind farms, you know, those are always going to be fewer jobs than the number of people building turbines or whatever. So, but anyway.
I agree with you. I just think that there was a lot of optimism sold and the bills come and due. And, you know, as the New York Times article points out, young people are noticing that bill's not getting paid.
I'm just saying I don't think it's a connection to the bill for young people. I think that there's this general malaise about the economy that, like, you know, is not necessarily directly connected to this stimulus package.
Okay. So let's stipulate that the economy won't change much through early November.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, let's go ahead and say the Democrats lose the House. We have Speaker Boehner.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just say it's a 50-50 Senate.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see happening in Congress? Before that, I want to back up. Before that happens, Congress is supposed to come back, not next week, but the week after. So we still have half of September, all of October for Congress to do something.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Congress is going to do on the economy generally, but more specifically on the impending tax hikes in January?
Yeah, I mean, the whole question about the reinstating the Bush tax cuts is kind of interesting, extending the Bush tax cuts is kind of interesting because they're, you know, the Democrats are advocating what I see as a compromise, which is, you know, preserving the cuts for people who make under $250,000 a year, excuse me, and restoring the cuts for the wealthy. And, you know, this is something that you can expect Republicans to say will, you know, affect small businesses as well as wealthy Americans, and that actually is not true because of the way our tax brackets are constructed. So I do think that, you know, they can do some good things with regard to the Bush tax cuts that are going to have, at the very least, long-term positive ramifications. I mean, whether or not they're advocating for keeping the cuts for those making under $250,000 a year actually has an impact on the midterms, I mean, I don't know. I think that again, it takes the public a long time to metabolize this stuff. So we'll see.
Who do you think is going to move first, the House or the Senate?
I mean, maybe no one will move at all. I mean, I would not be shocked if there was no movement on this, honestly.
I'm going to agree with you. Yeah. We debate this at Heritage a lot. You know, what's Congress going to do next? And I have a friend who says that Nancy's going to go ahead and go along with something along the lines of a temporary continuation mm-hmm. of all the Bush tax cuts through at least, 2011.
Right.
His thinking is that because you have people like Bayh and Dorgan and Nelson, Democratic senators, mm-hmm. who are already saying that we should extend the Bush tax cuts through next year,
yeah.
that really is what's going to happen in the Senate. And so, you're not going to be able to get Obama to come through on his promise to end the tax breaks for everyone over $250,000 because you've already got a whole bunch of Democrats already jumping ship and already saying that they don't think now is the time to raise taxes on people.
Yeah, I mean, but this fight for them isn't going to get any easier after the midterms. I don't understand. I agree with you that it might.
I mean, the people I mentioned, Bayh and Dorgan, aren't coming back, so they're not too worried about what happens electorally. They're retiring, and
sure.
Nelson's not up this year.
But regardless, I don't think the fight is getting any easier after the election. I mean, I think that this is something that, the Obama administration and, the Democrats should be willing to fight on now. There's no reason why, this fight is better for them later. I really don't think that.
No, I agree, but let me ask you more pointedly. Do you think that Nancy Pelosi would sign off on an extension of all the Bush tax cuts through 2011?
I mean, I don't know. I would like to think not.
I actually agree with you, which is why I do not think you'll see the House or Senate actually do anything on taxes before mm-hmm. before November.
Mm-hmm.
It's too big of a pill for Nancy to swallow. And I don't think the Senate is going to come to a compromise knowing that the House isn't going to do anything. They're going to try to make Nancy go first. Nancy's going to say no. And so I don't think you're going to see anything get done on the economic front between now and November.
I mean, I think that if they were smart, they would push it. I think that if they were smart, they would push, repealing the upper income bracket tax cuts. And that's money that, they can say, this is money that will shore up Social Security. This is it's fiscally responsible to do this. This is something that the Democrats should be able to use to their advantage in saying, this benefits lower income folks, the same people who are most impacted by the recession. And so, while I tend to agree with you about what will actually happen, I think it's kind of stupid on their part.
Yeah, well, I mean, the conservatives are going to love the idea of Democrats running on raising taxes on the small businesses that create the most jobs in any economic recovery. So,
right, well, and the actual research about how small businesses are impacted and the way the tax brackets are constructed, I mean, these are detailed things that are hard to communicate in political talking points. It's hard to say, actually very, very few small businesses would be impacted by repealing these cuts.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Wall Street Journal has a great editorial today kind of taking apart that Democratic talking point, Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama loved to say that only 3% of the small businesses are actually in the upper brackets, which is technically true, but that's only because I don't know if you have any on the side income. I know I do occasional writing gigs, so when I get that extra income and I put that on my income tax, mm-hmm. That counts me as a small business under the Nancy Pelosi rubric. So that's how they get that 3% number. Is that everyone at the American Prospect and Heritage Foundation and every other journalist in the country that does little side work on the side or people who sell money on eBay, they're all counted in that number. But when you look at the actual income, the amount of income that is generated by the businesses that would have their taxes raised by Obama, it's 50% of all that income. So it's actually a sizable chunk of the small businesses that are facing a massive tax hike.
But it's not small businesses the way that, most voters understand it. I mean, and when we talk about, folks who are creating jobs or potentially hiring or helping the economy. That's not folks like you and me who are making a little income on the side and are therefore counted.
Right. It's the larger small businesses that have enough income of $250,000 to be in that tax bracket.
I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I think that, the 3% number is actually pretty valid. I mean,
I just said it is valid, but that's considering me as a small business just because I write a couple articles on the side for, you know, X number of bucks. But I'm not gonna ever create new jobs with that. The small businesses that are going to actually create the jobs are the small manufacturers, the restaurants who do have incomes that are in the $250,000 range. Those are the people that are actually going to be creating jobs, and those are the people that are actually going to be hit by the Obama tax hike.
I mean, how much they're actually hit by that is the number, or is also subject to some debate.
And it's a debate I hope Congress has. We'll see how it turns out.
We'll see.
So moving on. To what happens after November.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of chatter on the left about what the Republicans will do, what a Speaker Boehner will do. Mm-hmm. What is your greatest fear of a Speaker Boehner agenda?
I mean, I don't know that I have a greatest fear so much as, you know, the sense of disappointment that the Democrats had this really great opportunity. And while I think that they've actually passed like a number of big agenda items, that, you know, watching that window close a little bit is my biggest sense of regret. It's not that I sort of fear a specific policy or a specific, a specific thing happening in the next Congress.
So it's just more of an opportunity missed.
Yeah, just like a general
thing.
Sense of a little bit of regret that, you know, like I wish that they had fought this a little bit harder and, you know, that there was a little bit more discipline within the Democratic coalition to get some of this stuff done. I mean, a lot of the folks that you mentioned earlier when we were talking about, I forget what we're talking about.
The Dorgans, Buys, and Nelsons.
Right, exactly. I mean, like, you know, these are folks that, granted, you know, have nothing to lose, but I would have liked to see the Democrats, you know, whip them into a little bit more shape.
So it's not you're not saying that you wish Obama would have done energy first as opposed mm-hmm. to health care, but just that when they had done health care, that the Baucuses and Buys and Dorgans would have and Nelsons would have fought for a better bill.
Right, which is not to say that, you know, I don't want to see Congress tackle energy or you know, I don't want to, it's not that I don't want to see, you know, Obama's plans for those things actually acted upon in the next Congress. It's just sort of like, you know, yeah, this sense of, like, you have the best chance you're probably going to get, and if you couldn't make some of this stuff happen, you know, I mean, I'm disappointed about that, I am, and that to me is, like, a much, much greater feeling than any concrete fear about a Speaker Boehner agenda. I mean, I'm not sure what that even looks like. I haven't seen, you know, there, as far as I'm aware, there's no specific policy agenda from you know, the NRCC about what they would want to do. I mean, when Democrats were elected in the midterms in 2006, there was, you know, this really clear plan. Like, this is what, you know, we want to come into Congress to do.
Which was
and
what?
While I understand the economy is bad. I mean, you know, there are all these factors that tilt the playing field in Republicans' favor anyway. I don't actually have a strong sense of what a Speaker Boehner agenda looks like.
Well, let's go back for a second. What was Pelosi's agenda coming in 2006?
It's 6 for 06. Maybe I should look it up. But I mean, I know that, like, you know, these were things that you know.
I think it would. I mean, I'm just trying to remember the top of my head. I think it would be like restoring ethics to Congress,
mm-hmm.
Ending the Iraq War. That'd be all I can think of. Do you remember anything else at the top of your head that Pelosi would try to accomplish?
Don't. I kind of feel like, and you know. I mean, like I said, I'm not saying that, you know, every single item on that list was, you know, checked off directly.
Right,
it's just,
right.
I do think that, you know, or even like the 1994 contract with America. I mean, there's some sense that, like, you will get these policies if you put this other party back into power. And I don't feel like I've gotten that from the Republicans at all in the midterms. Like, I don't have a sense. I mean,
yeah, and
you'll see
a very little kind of rollout come, you know, late September, early October, but it'll be mostly kind of small bore stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you do go back and look at the 2006 agenda, a lot of it was more kind of containing Bush, you know, defunding the Iraq War, restoring ethics to Congress, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is kind of what you'll more see from the Republicans, is not so much we have this great agenda that's going to transform the economy, but, you know, we're going to kind of stop the bleeding of the Obama administration. You know, we're going to try to defund Obamacare. We're going to stop the EPA from regulating carbon. Stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, getting rid of earmarks. So more of a limited staunching the growth of government agenda. And I'm fine with that. There's only so much conservatives could do with just one House of Congress. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're really going to start seeing a positive vision for the country and the direction conservatives want to take the country until the 2012 primary really kicks in. And that's what I think the debate should be. I think the debate should be by the 2012 nominees to say, here's my plan, here's my vision, this is where I want to take the country. And I would much rather have whoever is in the 2012 field, Pawlenty, Daniels, Ryan, Boone, Barber, whoever else is out there, I'd much rather have them outlining where they want to take the country than Boehner or God forbid, Mitch McConnell.
What about the more fringe Republican candidates? What are your thoughts on the self-identified Tea Party candidates in this election?
I'm going to have to ask you to be specific because my opinion on them depends on who you're talking about.
Oh, okay. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess like part of me in sort of my earlier comments about the Democratic coalition, it's sort of a broader question about how you think the Republican coalition will hang together if they do manage to get a majority.
Well, on the agenda that I outlined for Congress in between 2010 and 2012, mm-hmm. Which will be largely a, stop the growth in spending, defund Obamacare, stop the EPA from abating carbon, I think the Tea Party candidates are the perfect allies in that. They're all for that agenda. Mm-hmm. Rand Paul, Sharon Engel, Miller, I think they're all 100% on board with that. They're definitely taking the Republican Party in a more libertarian, anti-K Street, anti-corporate direction, and I think that's good. I think that'll fit well in with the levers of power that they will have, which will be limited. I think that will fit well with what they can do.
Interesting. And on a related note, did you attend the Glenn Becca Palooza on the Mall last weekend?
I did not. My mom is in town, and mm-hmm. we went up to the in-laws in Allentown, so I pretty much missed entirely the Glenn Beckathon. Uh-huh. I read coverage of it, and when Sang suggested we talk about it, I did look up on C-SPAN Glenn Beck's speech, mm-hmm. Which is actually only about 28 minutes long or so, mm-hmm. 20 minutes long, so it was digestible. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot less crazier than I was expecting it to be. It sounded, like a kind of what I would imagine a tent revival in the, 30s and 40s might be in Bible Belt America. So it, mm-hmm. it sounded pretty much like that.
I mean, I was there. I was sweating it out in the heat. And I thought it was kind of interesting, too. I mean, you're right. It was a very survivable 28 minutes for those of us who were standing there in the heat. I don't think it couldn't have been much longer. But the tent revival analogy is really apt. I mean, what I couldn't figure out is, if you keep saying it's not political, why hold this in Washington? I mean, I understand that, I obviously understand why, but it definitely had, I was surprised by the degree to which it felt like a straightforwardly religious event. The other thing that was interesting being there is, just this sort of general, and this has been an undercurrent, among conservatives for a really long time, but this anti-media feeling. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was so fascinating that this is a major rally organized by a media figure, like in large part about how we don't like the media. I was trying to think about precedents for this in terms of large gatherings of folks on the Mall, rallying for something, and being led by someone who is essentially a media figure, not an activist, a self-identified anyway, activist figure or political figure. I mean, I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, when I look at stuff like kind of the Becca Palooza, I always think of it more as just kind of reading another reaction to kind of the loss of the community within the country You know, people aren't as connected to their local churches, et cetera. So you see new kind of cultural institutions, you know, like Burning Man out in Nevada, or, you know, large music festivals and the rest of it that draw lots of people to come in and feel like a community. And I see it largely along those lines, that these are just a bunch of people who, you know, view the world in the same way and want to feel connected. And Glenn Beck, as an entrepreneur, saw that and came in and offered them a venue to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty apt. I think that, you know, most of the time when that happens, they don't do it with this sort of veneer of, you know, coming to Washington unless they actually have a political agenda. Because, you know, I was also thinking about the fact that I was at the March for Women's Lives in 2004, which had kind of a similar feeling, right? You know, like, you know, people, we don't like the people in power. We kind of feel generally threatened. We're going to come together with a group of like-minded people. In a lot of ways, it felt similar to me. And the only difference being that we had a political agenda. Like, you know, there were certain political things that we wanted from the federal government, mm-hmm. and, you know, and those were made concrete. And I think that, you know, saying it's not political is all well and good, but, you know, you need to actually, I don't know, there was no addressing of that fact that, you know, most people gather in Washington to ask something of government.
Yeah, I think, you know, David Weigel specifically compared it to the Million Man March, and I think he took some heat from that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean the Million Man March was really more kind of internal, gazing at that community as opposed to coming to Washington to ask for anything, right? If I remember correctly.
Yeah,
I don't think the Million Man March came to Washington and was like, here's our agenda, go to it. It was more like, you know, there's something missing in our lives and we need to change the way we're behaving.
I mean, that is, I mean, I don't know, maybe that is the most apt comparison, honestly. But, I mean, I also think that there was also no reason for that to be held in Washington, per se. You know? I mean, I think that, you know, there's the sort of Glenn Beck as a political figure is, I'm just shocked by how receptive people are to him walking that line. I mean, just continually surprised.
In what way are you surprised? I mean, do you feel as though Glenn Beck is a huge fan of, like, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, and he's ready to toe their line when they need him to?
No, but, I mean, he certainly has beliefs about, you know, the way the country should be run. And I think that if you watched his show, you could glean a Glenn Beck agenda. You know, it's anti-immigrant. It's, you know, get the federal government out of all areas of life. It's, you know, it's Christian. I mean, it's like, you know, we are a Christian nation, prayer in school, that sort of thing.
You know, I watch not a lot of Glenn Beck. I don't really see him doing too much of the immigration number.
Well,
I could be wrong.
I mean, he ebbs and flows, right? As most media figures do, they have a couple of issues that they hammer on for a while, and you know, and that's sort of like a theme, you know, of their few months, and then they kind of move on to, like, the next core issue. And so, well, maybe that's not what he's talking about today. I do think that that was sort of a foundational Glenn Beck issue.
But, you know, Glenn, I do think it's important to pay attention to which ones he does hit on, which ones he doesn't, because Glenn, of course, is in favor of gay marriage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's not going to be hitting on stuff like that. I think he's been 98%. I could be wrong. I think he's been almost 100% absent on the Ground Zero Mosque Park 51 issue, which would seem to be up any demagogue's alley. He seemed to take a pass on that. And I'll have to look it up, but I don't remember him doing lots of carping on immigration.
I mean, that was sort of, you know, in when he was still on CNN, that was, like, his thing, like, on, you know, before he made the leap to Fox. So, I mean, I'm talking about a while ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he definitely evolved in many ways. No, he's a fascinating figure. Have you ever listened to his radio show?
I have. I mean, I can't say I'm a weekly listener, but I have heard it, yeah.
I was struck by just to me it seems like he has a very different personality on the radio than he does on his TV show.
Well, he came up in the sort of like the, as I mean, not shock jock is the wrong term, but, you know, the sort of the morning drive time
radio
tone. And, you know, and you can see a little bit of that, you know, at the rally on Saturday. There are the sorts of anecdotes and the way of, you know, the type of humor that definitely sounds like morning radio still to me. So yeah, I mean, and it obviously makes sense that his radio persona would be slightly different from his TV persona.
Yeah, I just don't, when I listen to the radio, I don't get the same, you know, kind of chalkboard, connect the dots, you know, kind of X-Files conspiracy theme that we get on his TV show. That on the radio show, it's more of a more comedy, you know, just kind of making fun of stuff, more conversational, as opposed to, you know, these set 10-minute production pieces of, you know, making these elaborate cases on the chalkboard and with props and the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, Salon ran an interesting series of articles about you know, his past and how he came up through media that was really interesting, that that had a lot of things to say about that, about his roots in radio, that that I read before the rally and found really fascinating, so...
Yeah, and as far as it being religious, it was very non-denominational, right? I mean, he of course is a Mormon.
Well, the Judeo-Christian term was used a lot. So in as much as, you know, yes, it was non-denominational. But, you know, for example, I know that there was this ban on signs, and the one sign that I saw all over the place that they didn't, you know, most of the time organizers were asking people to take down their signs if they had them. And the one that sort of remained was one for achristiannation.com. And, you know, yeah, the term Judeo-Christian was used liberally. I mean, the fact that when the pledge was said, there was a real sort of emphasis on the under God. You know, the folks around me were sort of shouting that part of it. And definitely that was like the unifying thread.
So, I wasn't there. I only saw the Beck speech on C-SPAN, but there was a whole program, right?
Oh, sure.
So was there any other speakers that kind of stood out for you that were noteworthy in any way?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. They had some military families, folks like that. You know, it was actually kind of similar to the types of folks that you see, you know, mentioned as anecdotes in, like, State of the Union addresses. You know, Obama's done it, Bush did it, too. It had that kind of feel to it, which is... You know, let's talk about a couple of real stories to highlight or underscore the points we're trying to make. You know, one thing that I noticed that in the Sarah Palin speech, and Sarah Palin was introduced as military mom, you know, not a politician. That was over and over. They said, you know, we brought you a military mom,
which is at least accurate.
I mean, well, sure, sure. That's like saying, you know, like Barack Obama, Chicago resident. She said something about how, you know, we're here to restore honor to our troops, but of course, you know, they've never been without honor. It's always been honorable to serve. And it was sort of interesting that, you know, squaring that circle of, you know, it's always been honorable to be a member of the U.S. military, but also we're here to restore, you know, this nebulous notion of what's been lost. I mean...
Yeah, I never really got the whole marketing from begin with, restore honor. I was like, I don't get it. I mean, that's... In what limited sense I do get it, it's more of like a revival of, you know, we've lost our way, we need to return to God. It's like, okay, so, you know, this is just the modern tentless version of religious revival.
If only there had been a tent, it was real hot.
Oh, some misting machines or something.
Yeah.
So did you watch the President's Iraq speech on Tuesday night?
I didn't watch it at night, but I watched it online the next day.
Okay. Well, I actually stayed up and watched it that night.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think?
I don't know. I mean, in some ways it's funny. I know you referenced Mission Accomplished earlier. You know, in some ways my cynical point of view was that this was a Mission Accomplished only without the Bush theatrics of aircraft carrier, codpiece, and flight suit. You know.
Right.
I mean, we still have 50,000 troops there. I mean, in some ways I know it's good for him to sort of say, look. You know, I set out to do, or I did something that I set out to do when I ran for president. But, you know, the actual quote that he used about the Iraq War on the campaign trail a lot was, I don't just want to end the Iraq War, I want to end the mindset that got us into the war. You know, and that was sort of something that was a strong selling point to me about Obama, just because it didn't make it about this one conflict that clearly we were going to be mired in because of because of inertia, because of the amount of money invested, because of the Bush administration's failure to look at consequences for invading Iraq, that ending the mindset seemed to me to be the most important part of that. And you know, Obama hasn't really convinced me that he has ended the mindset in vis-a-vis his approach to Afghanistan. So yeah, so in some ways I kind of had, you know, a shrug my shoulders reaction. But I don't know, what was your take?
Well, I think that's an interesting that you didn't feel that there was a campaign pledge met there, because my old colleague Reed Wilson was pointing out that from emails from Obama for America, mm-hmm. and from other Democratic strategists, that the White House was really hoping that this speech was kind of the kickoff of for their 2012 campaign, mm-hmm. is that they really wanted this to be a campaign promise met moment, and that they were going to, you know, try to use this as a transition to addressing the economy. So I think it's interesting that you as an Obama voter felt underwhelmed by the campaign promise met. I think that's going to matter when people start looking at 2012 and they either feel fired up enough to go out and vote for Barack Obama again, or they don't. And I think, you know, how well they feel Obama has, as you say, it has not only ceased combat operations, but, you know, changed the mindset, is going to affect intensity on the Democratic side.
Yeah, or if it will matter to voters that, you know, like, in some ways we've just changed Iraq for Afghanistan in terms of, I know they're very different, you know, political and national security issues at play in Afghanistan as opposed to Iraq, but, you know, to folks who have relatives serving overseas, the notion that, you know, Obama has ended the Iraq war is probably going to ring pretty false if their relatives have just been, you know, are just serving in Afghanistan instead of Iraq. So
I totally agree. I think Iraq's going to be a very distant, small memory.
And in some ways it already is.
You know, yeah, I mean, no, you're right.
And maybe this is a point in favor of some of the Glenn Beck ralliers, which is, you know, It slipped off the front pages and, you know, home pages a long time ago. You know, this is the conversation has long since shifted to Afghanistan. And so, you know, I mean, I will certainly be watching to see what Obama manages to do there.
So what do you feel Obama has to do on Afghanistan to keep his promise?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's really tough. I mean, the idea that, going back to that quote about the mindset that got us into war, you know, making really clear to the American public, you know, why we're in Afghanistan. I mean, I think that part of the thing about Iraq that he used to great advantage during the 08 election is that people had lost all memory of, you know, the Bush, you know, trumped up charges about we were in Iraq to, I mean, this was actually a theme at the Glenn Beck rally as well, that, you know, we went to Iraq for justice after 9/11, you know, a couple of different speakers said that, and you know, that was not only false and a bad reason to go to war, but you know, it sounds like
the Tom Friedman view to me.
It's not a rationale that translates to Afghanistan for sure anymore, anyway. And so, you know, the Obama administration making clear to voters, you know, we are here for these, you know, concrete national security reasons. And, you know, here's our plan for making this work in a way that Iraq didn't is going to make the difference.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough needle thread for them. Mm-hmm. Lots of deadlines coming up at the end of 2011, so we'll see if he meets those.
Yeah. I agree. And you know, and also, you know, the real lesson of Iraq is, we're really bad at determining long-term consequences when we start conflicts overseas. You know, fiscal consequences, like human life consequences. You know, real, you know, really looking at what's going to happen on the ground. You know, we've been terrible at that, and I think that knowing that a little bit more up front, you know, every time we either enter a new conflict or retrench ourselves, is perhaps the hardest lesson to learn.
Yeah, no, I think we're in strong agreement there. I mean, the hubris with which the, you know, the Bush administration, after Saddam fell, thought that they were going to, you know, rebuild this country from the ground up, is painfully striking to look back at.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that we're in a very painful place, how about we lighten it up a bit with some lawsuit news. And there's a suit in New York, which I guess got thrown out, and it is thanks to this lawsuit being thrown out, it is now still legal to have ladies' night in New York City.
I mean, what cracks me up about this lawsuit is, you know, this guy named Roy Den Hollander, which, I mean, I know I mentioned to you earlier, was profiled in the New Yorker a couple years ago.
Right. I saw the New York Post story, but I didn't see the New Yorker profile that you were talking about. So go ahead.
Incredibly amusing. I think you should look it up. You know, this whole view that ladies' nights are designed to benefit women just really cracks me up. You know, the idea that the draw is free drinks for women as opposed to drunk women for men is really shocking to me. Like, I really, I don't know. I think Roy Den Hollander has it all wrong.
So what else is he involved in that made this? I mean, I'm in total agreement. You know, mm-hmm. The idea that the ladies' night is a huge advantage for women is ridiculous. The stale point is obviously to let men know that there's going to be people other than men at the bar. So what other stuff is this guy up to?
I mean, I actually can't recall if he's had another. It's been a while since I've read the profile, but there were a lot of amusing anecdotes about how put upon he feels, you know, as a man in general and his tough lot in life. You know, there's a lot of
pain for drinks is really
pounding
getting
his
down.
Chest and that sort of thing.
Was there anything other than having to pay for his own drinks that he really thought was crippling his ability to reach self fulfillment or anything?
I mean, I can't recall, but you know, the types of figures that I mean, and this has been going on for quite some time. You know, this lawsuit. I have some experience. I get a lot of mail from men's rights activists, so you know, maybe that's why it was extra amusing to me to see someone profiled a little bit. You know, this notion that everything is really designed to disadvantage men in this world, including.
So what are some of these men's rights activist emails you get? What are some of the other issues they complain about?
Well, you know, I mean, child support. They don't like paying child support. That's like a big core thing. But also, you know, the fact that, you know, they just can't find a good submissive woman in America these days. I mean, it is real tough for them to find
is that how they actually put it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I've gotten some great mail about how, you know, and it's lovely with some racist tinges as well. Like, I've been forced to seek women from overseas because American women are just will not take, you know, dinner and a few dates as all they need to see what a great person I am. And they're always real angry. There's a real undercurrent of you know, women are taking things from me. There's this idea that they're losing things. And so, I mean, maybe free drinks for women was just the tipping point for our friend Roy.
Gotcha. Well, sticking on law front news, did you also see the Hooters lawsuit out of Michigan?
Oh, I don't think I did. Is this, fill me in?
Well, this is a Hooters waitress who had been an employee in good state. She had gotten good performance reviews mm-hmm. for, I think, like 6 months or so. Mm-hmm. And then she was on a conference call with her boss and, I guess, like the regional headquarters. Mm-hmm. And they told her to lose weight. Mm-hmm. And so she was insulted by this. And so she's suing them for, mm-hmm. Discrimination, the rest of it. And Hooters is coming back, fighting back, saying that, you know, that their waitresses are just like entertainment, and they have to look a certain way, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. So I was wondering from your well-established feminist credentials what you thought of this suit.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, that website, The Smoking Gun, a while ago published the list of hiring requirements for mm-hmm. Hooters.
I'll have to check that out.
And you know, in that... I mean, it's hard for me to be very outraged about this, right? You know, while I wish that we lived in a world where Hooters was not a draw for people, it's hard for me to get too upset about you know, the management requiring someone to lose weight. I mean, really what I want is for this woman to have other awesome economic opportunities so she doesn't have to work as a Hooters waitress. Like, that's really what I want. It's sort of beside the issue from the lawsuit. But.
So you were or were not outraged by the hiring requirements that The Smoking Gun posted?
I will say I was not surprised. You know, I I obviously wish that we lived in a world where people found all sorts of body types, men, women, whatever, attractive, and that there wasn't this, like, one cookie-cutter standard that Hooters is reinforcing with its hiring requirements. But that said, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, I sometimes I wonder how these things would play out if you sort of translated them to other types of physical restrictions. I mean, there was a lawsuit. I believe she was a casino employee, not in any sort of way where she was dancing or anything like that, but you know, a card dealer or something like that. She didn't want to wear makeup on the job and was fired because she didn't want to wear makeup and sued, and I believe she won. And you know, that sort of divide of, you know, the Hooters waitress recognized as, you know, her appearance being part of what earned her the job, and versus a card dealer, where it's a position where, in theory, your looks don't matter, is an interesting distinction to plumb. One I would have to think about a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I was kind of surprised because as a card-carrying Neanderthal who likes going to Hooters, mm-hmm. If anything, there's definitely not, in my experience, a cookie-cutter figure that they're looking for. It seems like a lot of my friends I'll drag to Hooters who are more refined than I am, and they're always kind of surprised that the waitresses are kind of more girl next door than Playboy centerfold.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was surprised that they would ask this woman to lose weight. She looked perfectly attractive to me. But you know, I as far as body types, you know, it's not just Hooter waiters that face this. I mean, if you look at like you know, sports and like the NFL, mm-hmm. you'll see quarterbacks you know, Doug Flutie or someone like that, who are, you know, if you're 5'10", if you're under 6 foot, mm-hmm. Even though you might be able to perform on the field, front offices aren't gonna look at you or hire you for a job because you're not the archetypal tall enough guy to start at that level, and they tend to overlook at things like height and stuff. I think that's just more of a factor of people being able to look at measurements as opposed to other more subjective qualities.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing is, you know, I mean, arguably athletes, I mean, athletes do make a living based on their bodies, you know? I mean, and while you and I might disagree about how narrow the physical requirements are for Hooters waitresses, it's definitely a job where your body is part of your, I don't know, your currency.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, I mean, if anything, you know, quarterbacks definitely make a lot of money between their ears. I mean, it's you need to be intelligent to be a quarterback at any level. Mm-hmm. But I would venture to say that it is less true among Hooters waitresses.
Yeah, but you need to be pretty intelligent to be a Hooters waitress who maybe sues, gets a little bit more mileage out of that.
Okay, I think we're closing on 50 minutes. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on today, Anne?
I don't think so. I think we got it.
Okay. All right. Great. It's been great talking to you. Have a great Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, you too.